Hey, what's going on, crypto family? So today we've got an incredible interview with the legendary Michael Turpin. So I let him do most of the talking. It's pretty incredible just to hear his thoughts and perspective on the market, his predictions, how he got to where he's at today, some of the incredible companies that he's built. We also speak about his lawsuit that he has against AT&T. We talk about BitAngels, Coin Agenda, and quite a bit more. You know, this chat offered, you know, some incredible insight into, you know, kind of how this legendary crypto billionaire thinks. And full disclosure too, Transform PR, it's a company of his, is actually an advisor to Monarch. So, you know, this interview isn't, has anything to do with about investing or any kind of particular coin or token. This is more about hearing, you know, Michael's story and his thoughts on, you know, kind of where we all are in crypto, where he thinks we're all going. So anyways, hopefully you're gonna enjoy it. Just kick back, grab a cold one. Just a friendly reminder, Crypto Beatles shows are never financial advice, recommendations, or trading strategies. The views expressed here are solely that of Robert Beatles and his guests. Robert Beatles is a co-founder of the Monarch Wallet, host of Trading View Sessions, Crypto Beatles on YouTube, and on several entities. Robert's opinions here do not reflect that of those entities. Some information shared here may not actually be factual. These shows are for information and entertainment purposes only. Never invest a single Satoshi or penny in anything without first seeking the counsel and advice of a professional financial advisor. Robert Beatles is not a financial expert or advisor. Investing in anything is super dangerous. You can lose all of your money, so always trade at your own risk. And one last thing before we get into this, please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the fam. All right, so without further ado, I give you Michael Turpin. What is going on, crypto family? So today we have the one and only Michael Turpin with us. The guy is a legend in the space, has done so much, and it's great to have you here. I know you're in Puerto Rico right now, right? So, you know, you got quite
I'm in Southern Puerto Rico, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I still have not been to Puerto Rico yet, so one of these days I'm definitely going to have to get out there. And you actually beat Brock. You know, Brock's talked a lot about, you know, Puerto Rico and how he had a movement to, you know, to basically get people there, and including himself, and you were actually there before him. I didn't know that. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, actually, though, Brock gives me credit for that. We both talked about it for a while before I took the plunge, and then he took another one. He refers to me as patient zero for moving to Puerto Rico. But I give him all the credit for really making, sort of the cause a lot better known and bringing a lot of people down with him. I mean, I came down with me and my wife. He must have brought 50 people with him, and continues both of us to go all over the world and, you know, talk about why it's a win-win for both Puerto Rico and for entrepreneurs and investors in the blockchain world.
No, it's pretty incredible. And, you know, we could talk all day about, you know, all the different endeavors that you've launched and all the successes that you've had, and we'll touch on some of those. But it's always great to, you know, kind of learn more about the person behind them and kind of what drives them and what motivates some and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, maybe to start with, you know, like, what's one lesson that you could, you know, maybe tell people, that's something that you learned that's like really valuable, some piece of advice that might help others to, you know, that aspire to try and get to where you're at, or just become, you know, successful.
That's a broad-based question. I'd say probably, you know, learn as much as you can about what you want to do. The most expensive learning is when you're doing it on your own without any kind of mentors or advisors. You know, learn, you know, watch other people who are, you know, successful at what you want to do. That's why, you know, going to conferences, whether you're speaking at them or just attending them and meeting people, you know, you might have an idea and you'll talk to somebody who's already, you know, had five or six successes in your space, and they'll say, well, that's a great idea, and it'll encourage you, and let me introduce you to someone. Or they'll like, you know, that's half a great idea, but it's not going to work because of this. Or, you know, there's eight other people doing that and you didn't know that. So I think really just educate yourself very thoroughly, as I think was Lincoln or someone said, you know, cut twice,
measure twice, cut once.
Yeah. Or the opposite is true. You want to really plan and think deeply about what you do. And then once you pull the trigger, give it a great shot. I mean, if it looks like it's not working, analyze why and move on, because sometimes it's just as bad to cut and run too early as it is to stay in too late. I mean, they both, you just have to analyze each situation and find out whether this really was a bad idea, or whether it's just the wrong time of market, or whether you just need to try a different strategy and you can persist. And, you know, that's the most difficult thing about being an entrepreneur, is trying to figure out when you were just wrong and nobody's going to make your idea work and you have to pivot, or whether, you know, people think you're wrong, but you know you're right, and eventually, you know, you're able to go in and make it work.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right there. I mean, there's so many different times you hear that persistence is the key to winning. You know, you fall off the horse and you keep getting up. You just have to get up one more time, then you fell off it, and you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But if you're pushing in the wrong direction, that's where the mentors and the people like what you just said, it makes a lot of sense to get the advice from them so you're not just going off in the wrong direction. That's some great advice right there. And for yourself, I mean, you've done so much, you've accomplished so much. You could have retired, you know, probably a thousand times over. What makes you so hungry? Why do you do what you do? What gets you up in the morning to make you keep, you know, doing what you're doing every single day and bringing value? And
well, I'm not particularly good at playing shuffleboard. You know, it's not my kind of idea. I mean, I certainly like to take time off, and my wife and I enjoyed, you know, drinking a good bottle of wine and, like, you know, touring around vineyards and things like that. It's sort of a hobby. But I like seeing in technology what comes next, and I like being a part of it. And I wake up and I have ideas, and whether they're my own ideas that I'm executing on or whether I'm helping advise companies and helping them with their ideas. And, you know, as long as I'm, you know, kind of healthy and passionate about doing things, I'll continue to do them. I mean, I've had two exits, you know, pretty substantial exits so far. I had my first PR firm was in the 1990s. We were one of the top, you know, leaders in, we were a top 25 high-tech PR firm, and probably, you know, among the earliest to really do what they call dot-coms. We launched the Motley Fool and Match.com, Earthlink, America Online Greenhouse. And, you know, we ended up selling into a roll-up where it was us and I think 16 or 17 investor relation companies, because we were feeding them all these companies that they could then take public during the frenzy. After that, I spun off something that I had actually started in the back of the agency, which was this crazy idea I had in 1993 that the PR services industry, which is primarily the biggest component, was press release distribution, was still in the horse and buggy era when, you know, everything was going into the internet. And so that really started what became Internet Wire. I started in 1993 on, like, a, you know, 14.4 modem. We launched in 94, and it, you know, took a couple of years for us to really kind of get some traction and have people say that the internet was not a crazy way to distribute company news. And then all of a sudden, when you know, the internet got hot, we were able to raise money from Sequoia Capital, and that company now, we sold it initially for about $35 million. It then got sold again for $100 million. It then got sold again for $200 million, and NASDAQ sold it last year for $335 million. So it's still around, being bounced around between different places and continuing to grow. It's called Global News now, which is a merger of Market Wire, which is what we renamed Internet Wire when internet went from being all things bad to all things good, and Globe News Wire, who was actually a competitor called Prime Zone, and then NASDAQ renamed both of them as Globe.
Nice.
Which is, I'm told, my committee, but I still like the name Market Wire. But at any rate, so that was my second exit, and you know, just went back to looking, do I want to do, because I had one agency and I had one product company, and I wanted to see what I wanted to do next, products or services. And at that point, social media was taking off. So I started a company called Social Radius. And, you know, we're working on some products, but it seemed like engagement software and analytics already had an awful lot of competition, and there just weren't a lot of agencies that knew what they were doing. So we got a lot of business in the social media space. And then when I saw, I mean, Social Radius was Inc. 5000 a couple of years in a row. And then 2013, I saw a blockchain and said, I'm going to make a pivot. I'm going to pivot from, you know, selling social media packages to big Fortune 500 companies to hanging out with these crazy crypto startups. I mean, I still did a little bit of work for companies like Philips and Marriott, but those slowly kind of became less and less of the attention. And that's when I kind of absorbed Social Radius into what became Transform Group. And so it's been called Transform since 2015. And I'm hoping we're going to make Inc. 500 instead of 5,000 this year. If I'm looking at the numbers, it looks like we're, fingers crossed, going to, you know, be an order of magnitude larger in growth.
No, that's an incredible story. And, you know, that's not even all of it. That's just a little bit. And it's great too that, you know, it transformed. A lot of people don't know that like 40% of the market cap of the alternative coins out there are basically, they came through you guys. You guys ran the marketing through
Transform. Yeah. We recalculated this every couple of months. Last calculation was 37% of everything is not Bitcoin. The 10 coin market cap is somebody we either launched or did the scaling campaigns for. Having been right at the beginning of Ethereum helps because that's the number two coin. We also did early incubator work with Ripple and Dash and launched Eternity and Aeon and Neo, Quantum, Tether, Gnosis, Golem. So a few of the names you heard of. So
yeah, indeed. And so when you came from the internet world, you know, it was pretty early then too. They were basically saying it was for like nefarious things, you know, for porn or for thieves or whatever. You know, the internet, we saw how it's basically evolved into something people can't live without nowadays, and people are glued to their phone. And I really think blockchain is kind of the same way. And you would probably know better than anybody, seeing as much as you've seen and being.
I absolutely agree. And I've been quoted a number of times over the years as saying I've seen this movie before. in the internet, I remember actually talking to a studio head in mid-1994, say, and he was like arguing with me that because they were just starting to figure out CD-ROMs, and they're like, there's no way that this network, it was one of the big three networks, will ever be on the internet. There's never going to be NBC.com or whatever. And he said, that's because my mom is not going to put up with having to have a second phone line and having to hear something go bing, 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 bing in the middle of the night. And, you know, she's just never going to be on the internet. What that did not take into account, and I think what a lot of people are not taking into account today about cryptocurrency and blockchain and all the different variations, is the GUI is still at that 1994 or maybe earlier level. If you are now trying to get your mom or your grandma onto the internet for the first time, when I had that conversation, I believe it was 20 million people in the world were on the internet. Today it's 4 billion.
Yep.
So in about 25 years time. And we have no reason to believe that blockchain will be any slower because the adoption curve has been pretty close to the curve of the internet adoption, social media adoption. I mean, it's kind of got this S curve where you go from the early laggards to the early majority, and then you have this huge growth over maybe a 10 or 15 year period where you go from under 10% to over 60% because it's just easier to come on and you're not cool if you don't have it. We're nowhere near that yet. And the reason we're not near there yet is, among other things, we don't have the GUI yet. And, you know, obviously we're going to talk a little bit about my lawsuit against AT&T. But, you know, the phone companies overall, if they could just simply get their act together to protect the current users of blockchain services by doing the simple thing and just simply not giving out their passwords. I mean, if they had passwords the way that Google has them, where you can't just call up a customer service rep and bribe them for your password, you actually have to type it in and it's pass-fail. It's shocking to me to find out that none of the major phone carriers protect your passcodes, but we'll get to that later. But they have an opportunity, I think, to be one of the major driving forces in blockchain adoption, because let's just flash forward a year or two and say that, you know, they solve their problem with what they've been, you know, negligent in. And in the early days of the internet, I remember that the phone companies hated the internet because they wanted to make sure that people were, you know, they didn't like VoIP. They thought it should be shut down. They didn't like, you know, people spending time on the internet. I mean, the cable companies as well hated it. They were all just like fighting each other in courts over all sorts of things. What's their biggest revenue sources now, right? I mean, you look at the cable companies, they make way more from broadband than they do from cable. And a lot of them are now, you know, just kind of almost phasing out on what we would traditionally call MSOs. And they're just offering everything, bandwidth for, you know, Hulu and Netflix and all this. And that's just the way that the technology is changing. You know, I foresee a similar path of adoption for blockchain where if you're, let's just assume that we're like in 2 or 3 years, there's actually dApps that are usable by millions of people, opposed to what the latest number, like 50,000 people have ever actually used a dApp, not traded it, just actually used it for what it's built for. And all of a sudden, it's like, say, 50 million people. And, you know, we haven't had our first Angry Birds. If you look at the Apple, the App Store, it had no traffic and people laughed at it in the early days. Then all of a sudden you had a little bit of a couple of games here and there. Then Angry Birds happened and boom, you can't remember a time when there weren't billions of, you know, downloads on the App Store. And that was a classic S-curve. In fact, it was probably a lot faster than the internet. I mean, the App Store has been out less than 10 years. Here, if you have any of the big phone companies, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, or Vodafone overseas, go and partner with or buy a Kraken, a Bittrex. They have instant access as a user of that service to 180, 200 million telephone accounts and vice versa. What's the biggest headache for users right now who say, hey, I want to get involved in cryptocurrency. I want to buy my first Bitcoin. I want to do this or that. Oh, you have to go in here and show a photo ID and a passport, and they have to, you know, KYC you. And this is to buy $50, right? No other industry do you have to, like, go through this kind of, like, scrutiny to buy $50 of something. And, you know, you have to go in, they have to mail you something, show it's your utility bill. Well, guess what? Your phone company already has that. Everything that KYC calls for, your phone company already has it. They've got your credit card information if you're paying that way. They've got your home address to send the bills to. They've got your identification when you first set up an account. So with minimal onboarding, they could go, and I foresee in a couple of years you're going to have TV ads and probably even more so internet ads that are the equivalent of what T-Mobile did a couple of Christmases ago when they were trying to onboard everybody for virtual reality. They were like, switch to T-Mobile and get the Samsung Gear headset for free. Well, you know, people weren't quite ready to, like, you know, slap that thing on their head, right, in terms of the mass market. They still aren't. There's definitely more blockchain users than VR users at the moment. But, you know, when you're getting at 100 million, 200 million users, and all of a sudden one of the phone companies says, we're going to be the ones to get it to the first billion users, you'll see ads that say, switch to the Verizon and get your first $250 worth of dApps free. And that's just the way you onboard people. That's in the early days of CD-ROM. You would have something where you'd buy one CD-ROM, it would have a couple hundred dollars worth of other, you know, trials software on it. And it's called a bundle. And it's, you know, marketing 101. And I see this happening. And I can't predict what month and which carrier, but I mean, there's no reason that it won't happen because it's going to make both sides a lot of money.
No, that's incredible. Yeah, no, like you said, you've seen this movie before. So what do you think is kind of like the technology or maybe the dApp that's going to be the one that...
Sorry, I just had a little iced tea. It's tropics here.
No worries at all. What do you think is going to be the genre or what type of app or dApp do you think is going to be what, you know, kind of catapults us, you know, forward? Do you think it's going to be games? Do you think it's going to be financial services? What do you think is going to be that one thing?
Well, I mean, obviously we already have a dApp of financial services. It's called sending Bitcoin to someone, but sure. Not even a dApp, it's an app. But because of the regulatory issues and all the different things, I mean, I think the answer is probably three or four categories. Games historically have been the ones that spread virally first. You know, your first augmented reality one is Pokemon Go. Your first, you know, real hit in the App Store was Angry Birds. Your first phone game was Snake. Your first computer, you know, viral app was Pong. Not the first spreadsheet. So I do think because of the way that cryptocurrency is able to transfer, but you know, you're going to also have things like a Venmo using a Venmo-like thing using stablecoins, right? You're going to have a number of different variations, which that's not really a dApp. It's kind of a financial app. It's a service. And so those are already there now, but you know, nobody, they're not in the millions of users of people who that's the first thing that they've tried, unless you consider that Bitcoin has millions of users. But, you know, I think most, you know, Bitcoin users, I mean, I certainly spend Bitcoin and I certainly accept Bitcoin. But, you know, there are many people who just they're investing in Bitcoin and they're hodling, right? And that obviously is a reason why during accumulation periods, like many are calling this one now, that the price has to go up because as more and more people are not spending it, but they're buying it, it's just supply and demand. But I think in terms of, you know, the pure dApp or tokenized app. I like tokenized app rather than dApp because I don't think that all blockchain applications have to be decentralized. Facebook certainly won't be decentralized when they do their, you know, payment app when that comes out. You know, Amazon may have something that has a shopping and loyalty and everything else in one. It won't be decentralized. I mean, I think tokenization is really the killer app in most dApps, not decentralization. Decentralization is important for something like Bitcoin when you're, you know, not wanting to trust your government if you're in a third world country that's got massive inflation and all sorts of other reasons. But decentralization is not as important as tokenization in most consumer, you know, software.
Yeah, I would agree, especially when you look at, you know, kind of the adoption curve thus far. Everything has been through centralized services. Decentralized services haven't really taken off. You know, people store cryptocurrencies in like decentralized wallets, but the typical onboarding to crypto users are things like a la Coinbase, which is, you know, very centralized because it has that
well, and it's real simple because centralized services are able to make things cleaner and control the upgrade path, right? I mean, I'm hopeful that what happens is what happened in Linux and what happened in the internet, which is you have a happy medium where the underlying technology stays decentralized. I mean, the internet is distributed, if not completely decentralized, but it's not like owned by Google, right? But you're still able to develop without being, you know, just sort of like kicked out of the room as being evil. Centralized applications. In the early days of the internet, you know, it was considered evil to have something that was centralized there as well. There was this group of people called the Real-Time Blacklist. It was like, you know, three guys in Monterey that had like, you know, ZZ Top beards, and everybody bought this information from them about who was bad on the internet they should be blocking. And if they didn't like you, you were off. You just couldn't get on the internet. You couldn't get an email address. AOL would block you. All these services would block you. And they would block you for things like putting ads up. There was a group of people who said advertising is incompatible with the internet. And I had a client in 1995 at an early advertising service. Oh, I literally had a reporter who said from like, you know, the New York Times or one of the big publications said, I can't write about advertising in the internet. It's immoral. Now, one of the biggest applications on the internet, right? Google and Facebook are the two biggest players. So, you know, as something goes from being dominated by the fringe, the early adopters, which we need the early adopters because they're the ones who have the vision. You know, if you want something to be used by billions of people, you have to make some accommodations for the mainstream. And one of them is to have the freedom to build businesses on top of blockchain. Right. And I think that there's room in the world of innovation for everything from a completely permissioned blockchain like you've got with JPM coin and things like that to completely decentralized. It just takes a while to agree on scaling like Bitcoin and things in between. I mean, most of the dApps out there really aren't decentralized. I mean, they're ERC-20 tokens that, you know, are not, you know, run by, you know, thousands, if they're not being mined from scratch, they're usually pre-mined. If they're pre-mined, it means there's usually some kind of governance there that rests with a company or a foundation.
Gotcha. And then as far as like capitulation, like right now, I think, you know, personally that we've seen all the weak hands leave. And right now what you see are, you know, the bag holders, you know, just the hodlers waiting for it to go back up, right? They're accumulating more or they're, you know, just not doing anything, just waiting for the market to go back up. For those people right there, what do you think, you know, basically we're looking at, you know, time frame wise before we start seeing the market go up? We've seen what $100 million does to three exchanges. You saw what it did to our market cap, and we've pretty much stayed up since that real money came in through real exchanges. What do you think it's going to take to start, you know, getting that that hockey stick, you know, for the people that are waiting?
Well, you know, as everybody discloses or warns, this is not professional financial advice. Do your own research.
It's running across the
time. I have been following this for a while. And, you know, I mean, I get surprised on certain things. I didn't think that that the Craig Wright news was going to send it all the way down to 3,000 and change. I actually, you know, did enough like microscopic homework to make it a nice big buy around 3,200. So, but I honestly, if you had asked me before that happened, I saw like 6,000 on the way down get hit with resistance 5-6 times in a row. I mean, that seemed like a pretty good bottom. And because the facts change, you know, if the facts didn't change, I don't think we would have ever gone below 6,000, but the facts changed. And when all of a sudden you put in the possibility, even if it's remote, that Craig Wright not only is Satoshi, but he has or will have control of the Genesis block coins, and he will dump them to make sure that everything is gone except for SV, you know, that panicked people. And that's when it went down and people were talking about $1,000 or less for Bitcoin. And I think 3,000 was about as low as it would rationally go, even with short sellers really kind of pushing the narrative. And I think right now we're still not at 100% certainty that he's not Satoshi and that that's not a possibility. I think that enough has come out now that shows that if nothing else, there are some documents that he has put in that many people say were fabrications or were at least misleading to say, well, if that's misleading, maybe he really isn't Satoshi. I mean, I think it's clear that he was involved in the early days. I think it's clear that he has some Machiavellian tendencies. And so you have to figure out which of them is the highest part of the narrative in terms of whether this is going to actually lead to coins moving, which will change the narrative. It won't kill Bitcoin. Trace Mayer at a last coin agenda basically said, fine, let him dump him. I'll buy him. Then we'll have him out of the way. So is anybody who's ever cashed anything out at any point, the community come together and buy those coins if they ever went under, hey, they go under 1,000, under 100, I'm buying them too.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what do you think? Do you really think he is? I mean, he would put all this to bed if he would just sign a single transaction. But as far as the way he speaks versus the original Satoshi and the emails, it seems like they're two different people to me. It doesn't seem like they could possibly be, you know, the Satoshi we've all known and you know, love.
Well, I mean, I'm of the belief, and again, just this is nothing new. This is just sort of reading what other people have said. And having met a number of the people involved, I mean, Craig Wright actually spoke at the second coin agenda via Skype before anybody really knew who he was. But Nick Szabo insisted on having him speak. But you know, I think that it was probably three or four people in a project, and you know, this whole tulip trust is something that's a viable thing that maybe he actually can't move them because, you know, they're actually locked up in a Seychelles trust, or they have a smart contract that someone like Nick Szabo wrote, you know, and they can't be moved for a certain period of time. I think since most of those theories have revolved around the year 2020, we're going to find out if by the end of 2021 nothing moves, then I think that, you know, we're pretty safe to say that he doesn't have access to the Genesis block, or that he changed his mind about dumping them.
Gotcha. And let's maybe switch gears a little bit. You know, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grow up? You know what I mean? Because you've done so much. But what did you start off wanting to do?
You know, I always thought when I was a kid that I'd want to be in business of some sort. I just sort of thought that would be kind of a cool thing. I didn't want to, you know, work in a factory or be an astronaut or anything like that. I mean, I just can't remember at the very earliest ages, but I remember that, you know, I did think that being I didn't even know the word entrepreneur then, but I thought owning something that I created would be a cool thing.
So you've obviously done what you've, you know, aspired to do as a kid, right? Growing up and creating all these, you know, businesses, which are incredible. What's maybe one of the lessons you learned along the way that, you know, people could really benefit from hearing? Because not everything was easy. Obviously, you had probably a lot of, you know, hurdles and obstacles and things that you had to push through to make all this happen. What's like one of the biggest lessons that you learned in getting to where you've gotten?
Well, I think market timing is arguably the most important thing that you need to be observing. You could have had, you know, Google in trying to fund it a week after 9/11 and everybody would laugh at you, right? I mean, they got funded before the dot-com crash, and they were able to just sort of work away in quiet. And then when technology came back, because there was a period of time after the dot-com crash that everybody thought that consumer technology companies were just a joke and they were unsustainable. And people were saying short Amazon when it was $6 and because they were going to go out of business. Then obviously it came back and went to $2,000. You know, the narrative changes. Markets are very panicky. And, you know, when money dries up, I mean, you're not able to build your business, but you're able if you got the money before it dried up. I mean, if you look at our industry, it's very typical of industries in the early days, right? You go from when there was no money to all of a sudden when the stupidest ideas would get $50 million, right? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're so stupid, nothing's worth anything. And so you've probably seen some people talk about buildle instead of hodl.
Yeah.
So build with the D and the L reversed, yeah. Biddle. And I think that's important. I mean, if you look at some of the great companies throughout the last 50 years, they were built during recessions. Microsoft was built during a recession, Oracle, Sun, you know, Cisco, Dell Computer. I mean, a lot of these things were built during recessions, you know, right after stock market crashes. They were able to get really good people who'd been, you know, all of a sudden available for startup prices because these guys were out of work or whatever. And there wasn't this rush to like throw your product into the market too early, because during bull markets, you've got five competitors who are throwing their product out before they're ready, just to get the market attention and to get a higher stock price or a higher token price. And you don't play that game, you get left out. And, you know, then all of a sudden the ones that do play that game and they don't really have what they say they have, or the market says, hey, you know, you only have 10,000 users. We don't care if it's cool. We want to see profits. You know, this is just, the market is the most important thing. So you can have the greatest idea in the world, and if you launch at the wrong time, you have to wait out the market. And so I think right now we're in, you know, we have different cycles in the stock market. The stock market, if you look over the last 100 years, has fairly predictable 7 to 10 year cycles that typically end at the end of a decade. You know, and then they're followed by the slow buildups and then quick crashes. And then the government jumps in and prints money or creates jobs programs or whatever they do to make it recover. With crypto, it's the opposite. We have 4 year cycles that are based on the halvings. And until Bitcoin isn't the dominant player in the field, you know, we were talking about the flipping with Ethereum not that long ago. And now they're saying, is Ethereum going to survive?
Right.
Right. So narratives change pretty quickly. And I don't think it's going to be a flipping anytime soon. And yes, I think Ethereum is going to survive and prosper. But I think at the same time, there will be a lot of competitors to Ethereum. In fact, there'll be a lot of competitors running EVM, just like there's a lot of competitors of Bitcoin forking it. But with those 4 year cycles, what I've noticed is that instead of having like the stock market, these slow bull markets and then quick drops, you have a parabolic run up and then a slow letting the air out of the balloon. And that happened in 2013 when we went from, you know, $100 in August when the first ICO happened at MasterCoin to $1,200 just in November, you know, 3 months later. 3 months later, went from 100 to 1,200.
Yeah, there was a lot of panic in the streets.
And then all of a sudden, because, you know, it typically overshot what it probably should have been at that time. And there was all sorts of reason, Mt. Gox, Willy Bond, all this stuff. And, you know, when the bubble pops, which oftentimes it does for technical reasons, if nothing else, everybody's looking for excuses, and then everybody's just like name calling, right? Oh, we're so stupid. You were so stupid. Send this person to jail, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then so bad news gets accentuated and good news gets ignored in the down market. Silk Road all of a sudden became this, you know, ginormous death of Bitcoin thing. Whereas, you know, there were dozens of things that were bigger than Silk Road in terms of dollar volume. They got shut down since then, but because the narrative wasn't death of Bitcoin during 2017, let's say, it got ignored. During the bull market in 2017, you had all sorts of bad things happen. That's when China banned ICOs and Korea banned ICOs, and you know, China didn't want you to be, you know, even you know, buying on an exchange, and that all happened while things were still running up. And then all of a sudden, you know, really the pinnacle of Bitcoin, most people now in retrospective look at it being the introduction of shorting. So when you had the Chicago Board of Options come in and say, hey, you can do, you know, you can do options and futures and Bitcoin, and everybody's like going, great, institutions are in, let's send it to the moon. And a lot of traders I know just said, nope, that means they can short now. And if we're at something that has already gone up 20x, it's probably a lot of play in the shorting. And so I knew a lot of people just started shorting at that point. And retrospective, I wish I had done that too, right? But it was unclear if we'd reach the top. You never really tell the top until it hits. I mean, I can go any day and have one person talk about their golden doji versus their, you know, their Fibonacci versus, I mean, their 200-day moving average versus their 21-minute the moving average, or the, you know, I mean, so like, they're like tea leaves almost, right? I mean, right. There's some people just say, hey, just follow the 200-day and 50-day moving averages and ignore everything else, right? There's other ones that say, no, look for the death crosses. And, you know, so obviously, just like the stock market, if you ever watch Jim Cramer, I mean, it'd be nice if someday there was a television show with, the Jim Cramer of crypto, right? Maybe in 5 years there will be. For the home gamers, right? Because he always talks about, hey, let's bring in the charts, but then he always says, you got to look at the fundamentals. And the same thing here. You got to look at the charts, but you got to look at the fundamentals. The fundamentals in the case of Bitcoin, with the tiny exception of the period where we had the scaling wars, has always been pretty solid, right? I mean, we have more users, better interface, the fees are back down to something reasonable. You've got all sorts of places where adoption is starting to spark, like Brazil. They just had a record number of transactions. And so, you know, we're kind of on that path to 4 billion users in 20 years. But I think that we're going to probably have substantially higher prices well before that. And going back to the 4-year cycles, if you do an overlay map on 2013 to 2016, well, actually 2012 to 2016, and then 2016 to 2020, boy, it looks really similar, right? So we had the all-time run-up high price from 2013 was at the end of November, the year after the halving. Flash forward 4 years, all-time high, December, the year after the halving. And the halving was a little bit later in the year. Actually, no, it was a little bit earlier in the year.
Right.
But still, it seems like that fourth quarter, the year after the halving, 2 for 2 now. So I wouldn't vote against it being 3 for 3. So I mean, my prediction, just based on, you know, the trends that have been happening and based on the fundamentals not changing, is I think that we should be looking a lot like 2015 this year, which the all-time low was reached in January. Here, the all-time low was, if it doesn't go any lower, was reached in December of 2018. There was a long flat curve between, I think it was about end of January to the end of September, that it was very rare to have the price be anything other than between 225 and 275. And a lot of people did accumulation back then and looked pretty smart when it went to 20,000. I can't tell you the number of people who, you know, didn't buy at 1,000 who called me and said, should I buy some Bitcoin now? And I said, I am, you know, I like it at 250 and I like it at 5,000 right now.
How high do you think it's going to go? What's, say 5 years?
So I think that if I'm following the charts again, the things that I've noticed, some of this has been said before, some of this is just sort of my personal observations, is that in 2012, the halving to the end of the year was a 50% growth, $4 to $6. And then from the halving to the all-time high was 300x.
Wow.
4 years later, but you know, you went from only about 300,000 users to maybe million and change. So it was still pretty small and pretty small growth curve. When you went from the halving in 2016 at 630 to 19,300, it was again about a 50% increase between the end of the year, 630 to about 990. And then halving to the all-time high was about 30x. By the halving, you had about 25, 30 million estimated users. Obviously more wallets, but people who,
sure,
you know, try to figure out the wallet to user ratio, which is unknown, but it's can be guessed, and so you're talking 30x. So if you're following that drift, and again, a lot of it's going to depend on whether we have a higher growth of users in 2020 as a percentage versus 2016, and a few other things. But I would think that the least that we can expect is going to be a 3x over the halving, because 300x, 30x, 3x.
Right.
But on larger numbers, that would still bring us to an all-time high. So I right now think that we're probably going to be somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 by the end of the year, but it wouldn't surprise me if we were over 10. But I just think that you still have enough resistance and enough people who are saying, oh, God, I can get out, you know, I can cut my losses or whatever, that when it, if it hits 8, it's going to get pulled back down to 6. It's not going to be a straight line. But as you said, if somebody comes in with, you know, from a big institution or a big whale trader and comes in with $100, $200, $300 million across a couple of exchanges and, you know, drives up $2,000 really quickly, you know, and it stays there, you know, that could, you know, change everything, right? So, so these are the unknown factors, but I would, my personal guesstimate would be 7,000 to 8,000 by the end of the year. It's called 7,500, about 10,000 at the halving, which is May of 2020. That would then put it at 15,000 by the end of 2020, because 50% higher. And that would put it at 30,000 by the end of 2021.
Gotcha.
Then you're going to pop and you're going to drop. But I don't think you're going to drop 85% again, because you never so far have gone back to the high of the last cycle prior. So when you were dropping from 20,000, your kind of stop was you couldn't go below 1,200, or you would have completely, you know, eliminated what had happened to date on sort of the prior, you know, way that the parabolic runs worked. And so that means that if it's going over 30, it shouldn't drop back to 20, below 20. I think it probably will. So if it's only 30, so that might mean that maybe the parabolic run gets a little crazy and goes to 50 or 100. I think 100 is probably about the high that it can get in 2021, 22. I know Tim Draper said 250. Obviously, McAfee said it's going to be $1 million, or he's going to, you know, eat his dick.
I think he doubled down and said 2 million.
You know, and I think that if Bitcoin continues to be over 50% dominance, if it continues to do what it's supposed to do, if it's not replaced in some aspects by, you know, Dash or EOS or, you know, something we haven't even seen yet, in for certain aspects of the payments and the digital gold aspect, you know, you could certainly see $1 million Bitcoin within the next 30 years.
Yeah, it's exciting for a lot of people, for sure. And then, you know, you're the co-founder or founder of BitAngels too. And so a lot of people, you know, they like to buy things on sale. In crypto, we don't see that. We see the opposite, right? They panic sell at the bottom. They buy at all-time highs. You never see people buying on sale in crypto. And so being the founder of BitAngels, and when you're...
Well, that works with the stock market too, right? I mean, people are like, you know, just beside themselves day trading at the height of the dot-coms, and they didn't want to buy Amazon when it was $5.
Yeah, the good old human condition. But you're kind of like an oracle. You see things ahead of time. All you have to do is look at your track record to see that. So with BitAngels, when you pick these different companies to invest in, are you still doing that through this market now? Or what's kind of your philosophy right now with the companies that you guys choose to invest in?
Yeah, and again, BitAngels is a decentralized or rather distributed network of investors. So it's not a fund. I am a general partner in Alphabet Fund. So that's sort of my fund involvement. That's more of a digital currency fund. So it's not a venture investment fund. We typically do, you know, arbitrage trading, as well as, you know, when we feel the market conditions are right, we'll go in and, you know, get into early into different token offerings. But BitAngels, started out as equity investments. I'd say it's still a mix of equity investments and tokens. And it's just basically an angel group, right? So just like every city has an angel group where they kind of sit around, have breakfast, and, you know, toss over deals, and they're usually accredited investors if they're doing equity, and tokens, depends on, you know, the country that they're in. But this is just really, as we're moving it now into physical events, we're in New York, San Francisco, and LA on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. And we've got Berlin, Miami, Hong Kong, London, San Juan, Las Vegas, and a couple others teed up for the next few months, Singapore. And so we're looking to be about 20 cities by the end of the year, and I'm hoping for 50 cities by the end of 2020. And these are all basically where you get a city leader who's somebody who ideally, you know, knows both the investor community, not just crypto investors, but mainstream tech investors, and also has you know, a steady access to startups because they know the incubators in town, they know the hackathons, et cetera. That person then, you know, comes to us and says, hey, I want to be the person for Pittsburgh. And we look at the city and say, hey, do you think, you know, we don't really put on cities we don't think they can do four times a year quarterly, because we don't want to have something where somebody goes in maybe from another city and four people show up.
Right.
But you know, I think for the most part, I mean, you know, we're getting close to 100 people showing up in San Francisco now for every bit angels. You know, it's one of these things that's going to evolve. Different cities will have different different types of things that they focus on. Perhaps in, you know, Korea, you know, we'll have Seoul coming on this year. In Hong Kong, you'll have maybe more token offerings, and in New York City, you're going to have more, you know, STOs or venture investments, and you know. But we basically go in, and so the model for Bit Angels is the companies apply. There's no fee. We just charge for admission, and we charge for memberships, for, you know, which then also get different benefits like discounts to Coin Agenda and other conferences, and for sponsorships. And so the sponsors basically pay for most of it, and global sponsors, so that the startups don't have to pay anything. They just apply, and between the city leader and people at Global, we determine, you know, okay, we like these three or four for this particular time, and then kick the B-level people down to the next one, or say maybe you can, you know, apply for a city nearby. And we let them present, you know, once per round, which usually is going to be once per year. And that's kind of, you know, what the formula we're working on. And we think it's a very good thing to be working on during during a bear market. Because, you know, it's a lot less expensive to put on than you know, having a couple other high-end shows in Europe and Asia this year.
Yeah, so you got kind of like this decentralized, you know, nodes of all these different investors and all these different cities. And that's incredible. Yep. Because, you know, basically, I don't care how good your idea is, without funding, it's not going to take off. It's not going to go anywhere. You need somebody to, you know, kind of feed the fire in the beginning to get it going. And so through this bear market right now, what do you see like the level of investment in each one of these meetings?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of funny that somebody said the ICOs are dead because there was only 180 million in quarter one versus 6 billion in Q1 of 2018. 180 million is more than we had in the entire years 2013, 14, 15, and the first half of 2016 combined. So if you told me in 2015 that 180 million a quarter was a bear market, I'd say bring on the bear market. So I think that good ideas, good teams get funded very quickly. I think that we're just changing the narrative a little bit. Just like, you know, you never hear anybody call an internet company a .com anymore. You didn't say Facebook.com. You didn't say Google.com. Yet after consumer internet companies were basically pronounced dead in 2002, it was only 2 years later that Google went public, and, you know, a couple of years after that, that Facebook did. And it's because consumer internet was not dead. They just didn't call them .coms anymore. And I think that ICO has such a tinge of a name. That's why now you're seeing IEO,
right?
Initial exchange offering. Well, the original ICOs, quite a few of them actually were on exchanges. And because you didn't have, you know, sort of the ERC-20 token, where you could just have an address and just throw your ether there. So you typically had to have a place that was trusted by people to be able to send it. And exchanges are, you know, more trusted than, say, a first-time founder. I mean, the very first ICO, you had to trust the founder, J.R. Willett, and the board, which included, you know, David Johnston and the Bit Angels, that we were looking over the process, that he wasn't going to go run away with the money. And we visited him in Seattle and, you know, just sort of decided that, you know, he'd been working on this. And, you know, the entire amount raised, I think, was $600,000. So, and that was the first ICO, and that was a lot of money back then. Wow, you can raise $600,000 on a token sale. You know, flash forward a couple of years and it's $250 million for
4.1 billion
for Tezos and Filecoin.
Or 4.1 billion with EOS. So
That's true. Of course, that was over a year. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's correct.
And, you know, there at each one of these meetings, how many people usually pitch and how many people out of those usually get funding of some sort?
So it's typically about four that pitch. There's also usually, you know, somebody who's maybe talking about legal, a lot of times legal sponsor, and there might be a speaker who's kicking things off. It's a breakfast. It's usually about, you know, two and a half hours, and too early to say who gets funded, right? I mean, because we're not a fund that's reporting. It's you meet people and then they come back and, you know, we try to follow up with the investors to, or with the companies to see, did they get funded from anybody they met there? I know the very first year of Bid Angels, when it was just all online, I think we had about 50 or 60 companies that presented. And I think there were like, I don't know, 8 or 9 that got funded. But, you know, there was a couple of substantial ones. Obviously, MasterCoin was the biggest one. And, but, you know, I mean, I think just like Tech Coast Angels or New York Angels, I mean, what we don't do is we don't do sort of like a big funnel where we have to have a committee to decide who gets to the next level, the next level. We just hold enough of these that if you at least, you know, get a couple people liking your deck, you're going to get on stage somewhere.
Nice. And then a little bit earlier, we spoke about, or you had mentioned, you know, the AT&T hack. So for people that don't know, basically you had all these parameters set on your phone where nobody should be able to change your service or have access to it or anything like that. But somehow somebody was able to basically get access to your phone and steal from you, right? You kind of want to talk about what happened and what the...
Yeah, I mean, it's if you Google Turpin versus AT&T, you can see the whole lawsuit, and there's a big writer's story when we filed. There's been a few things since then. But no, it's pretty shocking that most people don't realize that the major phone companies don't protect your identity. They basically... I mean, if you go to a bank and you forget your PIN number, you can't ask the teller to look it up and give it to you. Because right. If she could do that, she could go put it in herself and take out money. With the phone companies, everybody who's at the store has access to see your PIN. Instead of the, I mean, the complete solution to this is two things. Well, three things, actually. I proposed this for a law that's under consideration right now, and I've proposed it to every group that works with telephone companies. Problem would completely be solved if they did three things. Number one, don't give out your PINs. And then you typically have two levels of PINs. If you're just an ordinary customer, they give you a 4-digit PIN, and that can be changed by you. Or if you're high security and you're afraid that someone's going to hack you, you get a 6-digit PIN, and that can't be changed by you. You have to go, you know, into a store and prove a whole bunch of times who you are to change it, or do it through the fraud department. However, what they don't tell you is that even though you can't change it, it's visible to tens of thousands of AT&T or other phone company employees, because it's not like where, you know, you have to punch it in and it says pass fail. Literally, you say who you are, it calls up, they see it. Well, that means they can be bribed to give it to someone else. And that's what we believe happened in our case. That's what the records actually say, because we have the AT&T store records indicate that, you know, somebody in the store actually put into the records that, you know, I came into the store with an ID and the ID didn't work. So they did a manual override. Well, obviously I wasn't in the store, and typically a manual override is going to be done by somebody who's been part of the inside job or bribed to do that. In many cases, there was a big article in Motherboard about some other things. I mean, there's several hundred cases now that all look the same. And it's just shocking to me that to stop the damage, rather than just, you know, spending a lot of efforts fighting these lawsuits, you know, and they're feeling pretty cocky because you can't do a class action lawsuit against a phone company. They got a Supreme Court ruling on that, on something completely not regarding SIMs and completely not regarding crypto. I guess they thought, you know, they want to protect, you know, the courts from too many, you know, gee, I'm suing because I got a crank call or something. You know, because you can't sue in a class action suit, they're all individual cases. You know, we believe we're going to prevail in terms of showing their negligence in allowing someone to, you know, give up access to my digital identity without my permission. And, you know, we hope also that the laws will be changed.
Yeah, I mean, I've been SIM card hacked twice now, once from T-Mobile and then once from AT&T. So one of the things I learned, you know, long ago is never keep crypto on my phone or any kind of.
Well, I never had crypto on my phone. That's not what happened. I mean, what happens is you literally have your digital identity tied into your number. So once they're able to go and get control of that, it's not just your phone. It's any password that you have to anything. And all of my exchange accounts are protected by Google 2FA. I mean, some people just speculated that, oh, I didn't have Google 2FA on my Coinbase. I don't have a Coinbase, you know. So, but the issue is that once they have that, they can hack into all sorts of things. I mean, they literally hacked into my into my domain server. I mean, they hacked into all sorts of things that if the phone number is anywhere attached to it at any time, and in some cases you can't remove them, or it's very difficult to remove them, or you forgot that when you first ordered the software, you even had it on there, they're able to go in and, you know, just create havoc. And it's not just crypto. They're able to go in and, you know, hack into emails in some cases and find out that you have a certain credit card. And then they'll go and order the credit card to be delivered emergency to their address, and, you know, like a drop address that they'll pick it up and then run up to the max before you find out anything happened. These things can be stopped very easily, and they need to be stopped very easily. And, you know, we're going to make an example out of them. And so I've got three goals. One is to change their behavior so it's safe for the whole industry. Number two is to be compensated for my loss. And number three is to break up these gangs. And, you know, that was the second lawsuit, because the person who we believe was the SIM swapper, and we have a lot of evidence, as does law enforcement, is now in jail on six other SIM swaps. He hasn't been charged in mine yet because different group is who's investigating him versus the other six. But, you know, we
is he big out of California?
He's in jail in California. He was New York based. But the REACT Task Force of Homeland Security has an easier time getting warrants than some of the federal investigators do. They have different hoops they have to jump through. But they should be pretty close, I think, to being able to make some arrests in my case.
Well, maybe at the end of this, you'll end up owing AT&T, and so you can go buy Kraken and basically fulfill the prophecy you said at the beginning of this.
I don't think I'll be able to buy AT&T, but I think for the most part, I'm hoping that they'll see that this is not a lot that we're asking to simply keep consumers safe. And once they're safe by implementing, you know, very small changes, then they can look at the blockchain community as being an opportunity instead of looking at somebody that they have to worry about suing them.
Yeah, it's a great point. A lot of people don't realize too is that, you know, as soon as they have access to your phone number, a lot of people, they have all of their reset codes tied to their phone number. So if they want access to your email or to your bank account or things like that, they basically just hit those different providers. And then they have a...
Well, typically what happens is that there's a gang, right? So what they have is they have one person. It's just like a bank robbery where you have you don't have one person rob a bank. Usually you have a person in the getaway car, person with a gun, person holding the bag or whatever, and person looking out for the cops. And it's the same thing here. You have a person with the SIM swap, and then you've got all the actual people who are criminal hackers all sitting in a Skype room together, or a Wicker room, or whatever online service they have, and saying, "Hey, I'm in this one. Give me the SIM code. Hey, I'm in this one. Give me the SIM code."
Yeah, and then when they get the reset code sent to your phone number that they've hacked, they're able to access all these different accounts and start, you know, taking money or just getting access to different things. And how much money did they end up hitting you for?
It's in the public filing. It's $24 million.
Wow. Now, when's your court date coming up for this so we can all start?
Well, that's up to the federal judge. And, you know, the federal courts are moving very slowly right now. We filed in August in federal district court in Los Angeles. And AT&T made sort of they asked for a couple of delays. They finally made their motions to, you know, throw it out. And we said, no, this is why it's not going to get thrown out in December, and amended in January. January is supposed to be when they were going to give their decision. We're now sitting at the end of April. So the federal courts are moving very slowly right now. They had a little government shutdown in the middle. They've got a lot of immigration cases going on. So I don't control the pace of the federal court system.
So we'll talk about something a little bit more fun.
Lightning round.
Yeah. The lightning round. I like it. So what's maybe your favorite movie so far? Something you recommend others, something that you enjoy?
My favorite movies?
Favorite movie. Our favorite series.
Nothing crypto related, huh? You know, I kind of like thrillers. I've always been a fan of like The Blacklist and The Alien and, you know, those kind of things. So awesome. any kind of thrillers that do the impossible, you know.
Gotcha. What's maybe a book that's, you know, something you recommend to others, something that you find important?
Well, you know, there's a lot of good books out on crypto. I'm working on one myself.
What's the name of it?
It's, uh, it's going to be, I've got an agent, and I just have to, you know, get her a few things to be able to shop it around. But the sort of working title is called Pandora's Blocks. Hopefully that might be out sometime in 2020.
That sounds like it'll be important for all of us.
And, but you know, I read a lot of, you know, books just on, how to be better organized, how to run your business. I mean, I'm reading one right now that's by a New York Times reporter about habits.
Gotcha.
You know, I like all the get things done and Stephen Covey things. So.
All right, cool. And if you could be president for a day and you could basically change any law, make a new law, what would you do?
I think that's over my pay grade. you know, I think... you know, it's interesting that, no, I guess probably the law that I would have would be to take money out of politics. Basically, I mean, if you look at when they had the clean elections law in Arizona, and they basically said that, you know, you were able to go and put voluntarily on your tax return, very small amount, a couple of $10, $1,500, I can't remember what it was, that would go to something that gave matching funds to somebody based not on how much money they'd raised, but on how many votes they had, you know, in their initial canvassing. That was able to sort of, you know, offset a lot of the attack ads that kept incumbents in office. And they went in like 1 year from like 70 or 80% incumbency to like 45% incumbency because the little guy had a voice in running. And that got overruled because the trial lawyers of America went to court and said it was unconstitutional. I don't know what dog in the hunt they had, but no, I think taking money out of politics is a huge thing, and I don't know if it'll ever happen. The other thing is to have you know, fair elections globally. I mean, blockchain obviously would solve it. I think that the powers that be in most places don't want free elections. They want to be able to trick with their chads and with this and that. I years ago, before blockchain, said that you could solve the election problem very simply by having Visa, you know, run the elections. Do you ever? How often do you go anywhere in the world and get the wrong amount out of an ATM?
Right.
You issue a one-time ATM card for voting. You can print out the results of who you voted for if you want. It's completely optional on your part. If anybody asks, you know, here's the proof that I voted. And then you have to worry about absentee ballots because it'll work in any ATM in the world. Hmm. Had the idea 20 years ago, nobody's gone with it yet.
All right, and last question. I know you have to get to dinner. So say you have a no holds barred, like a UFC fight of sorts. It could be between any two people, living, dead, fictional, whatever.
A UFC fight, wow. I'm not particularly trained in that. I lift weights, but that's about it. UFC fight, probably Abraham Lincoln, because I think it would be look kind of cool to go after the stone fight Pat. And I guess probably Hitler, so I could just like kick him when he's down. I don't know.
Love it. Cool, man. Well, it's been great to hear your story. I know you got to get to dinner. I really appreciate you taking time for us in the community to just kind of tell us your thoughts on everything and all the things that you're doing. You know, we really appreciate what you bring to the community, and definitely don't stop. I look forward to seeing, you know, more of it. And I'll let you get going. So God bless and thanks.
Okay, thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, welcome back, peeps. Huge thanks to Michael for coming on and making time for us. You know, it's pretty incredible, you know, kind of hearing his thoughts on the market, his story, as well as, you know, the advice that he has, you know, for other people. Just a friendly reminder, Crypto Beetle shows are never financial advice, recommendations, or trading strategies. The views expressed here are solely that of Robert Beetles and his guests. Robert Beetles is the co-founder of the Monarch Wallet, host of TradingView Sessions, Crypto Beetles on YouTube, and owns several entities. Robert's opinions here do not reflect that of those entities. Some information shared here may not actually be factual. These shows are for information and entertainment purposes only. Never invest a single Satoshi or penny in anything without first seeking the counsel and advice of a professional financial advisor. Robert Beetles is not a financial expert or advisor. Investing in anything is super dangerous. You can lose all of your money, so always trade at your own risk. And one last thing before we get into this, please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the fam. Always a great time. God bless you. Love you. Catch you on the next one.